Hi, and welcome to another episode of Hear Now the News. I'm Jerry Varnash. I'm pleased to have David Paterson joining me today. He was the governor of New York from 2008 to 2010, but for those of you outside of the Northeast, he's probably best known as an SNL character portrayed by Fred Armisen. The former governor has a new autobiography, Black, Blind, and in Charge, a story of visionary leadership and overcoming adversity. In it, he discusses his historic rise as a legally blind man to become chief executive of one of the largest states. We'll talk about the book, but also with this unique election season coming to a close, Paterson is here to express candor about how President Trump and his successor in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo, handled the coronavirus, including controversy surrounding nursing home deaths in the state. My conversation with David Paterson is next. I am honored to have with me right now former governor of New York, David Paterson. He was the chief executive in the state from 2008 to 2010. Has a new autobiography that's out. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. First of all, thanks for joining me today.
Jerry, it's great to talk to you any day.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. We've spoken. We were just reminiscing about the times that we've spoken, which really, I guess, dates back about 10 years already.
Yes. Just back in your days at another station.
Another station, and even when I was doing just media writing. So we definitely have connected over the years, and I appreciate the ability to continue to stay in touch. So thanks so much. What I want to ask you first off is this is going to be airing right on the week of the election, the day before the election. And well, with it almost here, millions already have gone to the polls, as we know, early voting, and there's been a lot of mail-in voting. We lived through the, I guess, shock 4 years ago when Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton, a surprise by many. It was what's supposed to have been Hillary Clinton winning, even a landslide by the last day. Should Americans be prepared for something like this to happen again?
Absolutely. In 2016, I actually predicted that Hillary Clinton would win the presidency, but what disarmed a number of friends of mine is I thought she would win by 1% of the vote. Well, she actually won by more like 2% of the vote, but that vote was not distributed in the right states, and the key states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan went to President Trump at that particular time. And I really believed up until a couple of weeks ago that the president would be well on his way to winning again. I mean, Senator Clinton, who I know personally, and Vice President Biden, who I've met a few times, are very down to earth. And particularly in the case of Senator Clinton, the person you know when you're a friend of hers and the image she projects publicly are not the same. And that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with her. There are just some people that aren't very good in that public environment. She was married to someone who was extremely good at it. And Senator Biden, same thing. I mean, I think he was beloved by his colleagues on both sides of the aisle and will be when this is all over. But right now, I thought the president would win, but the remarks that he has made in the past few weeks at times about seniors at nursing homes and saying that Biden should be in a nursing home and that kind of thing. People in those homes take it personally. And older people, and I'm becoming one of them, take it personally too, because you never know when you're going to be there. And it's almost as if the president wants to try everything that would seem like the wrong thing to do and still win. Remember, he had the Access Hollywood video 30 days before the election. Now, you had to count him out for dead, but he came back and won. And I think he likes this idea of making it even harder for himself and seeing if he can still overcome. And maybe he will. But I think compared to 2 or 3 months ago, he's made the terrain a lot more difficult than it needed to be.
Well, and from what you just mentioned there, I want to ask you, do you think that, and I heard this a lot 4 years ago when I was doing reporting for a radio station, I would go out and talk to people mostly on Long Island, but some in the city. Do you think that, and we heard this then, and do you think this is the case now where more people are fed up with President Trump as opposed to are enamored, really want Biden. We seem to have seen it last time where they were not happy, the overall electorate were not happy with Clinton. And that was really how they just kind of gravitated to Trump. Do you see that again?
Well, I think that a number of people who support the president have tremendous problems with sometimes his personal ethics. I mean, the profanity that he spews on radio stations and at rallies, this idea that you have to castigate anybody who's on the other side, that there's never, I don't agree with him, but I think he's a good public servant. You never hear that out of him. And this kind of acrimony really has no place in our society right now, where we're bereft of an economy. We are belittled by a virus that just seems not to go away. And we're all in mortal fear of what's going to come next. But at the same time, he projects an image of strength and he projects an image of confidence that I think attract a lot of people, even though they worry about how he would actually run the country. Whereas Senator Biden, who I think would actually be a good president, and I think he'd be one of these people that wouldn't try to run everything, would distribute to his agency heads and his cabinet members responsibility, and kind of in a way like Ronald Reagan, who didn't spend much time running things. He spent most of his time organizing things and had tremendous success. So I think that Biden kind of knows that he would need a team more than the president, who's like, I'll do it myself. But those people who, while they're kind of fed up with him, they're sort of not quite ready to disengage with him because he does have that personal appeal of strength, even if that strength is often headed in wrong directions.
Also, you said that, you know, so many people look at his strength and appreciate that strength that they don't necessarily see the same from the other candidates, despite the experience from whether it was Hillary Clinton or obviously now Joe Biden, the former vice president, of course, under President Obama. Do you see with President Trump the fact that he has not what it seems to have built his base at all? It seems to have stayed, if not gotten smaller in these 4 years.
Well, I think he built a base beyond where he first started when he was elected president. But then he has certainly frightened people in the suburbs, particularly women. And then he says, come on, please love me. You have to vote for me. I fixed all your damn problems, but a lot of those problems really haven't been fixed. But then seniors were very much in favor of him in 2016. He's evaporated that in some degree. And then this notion that I got the virus, now I'm immune, I couldn't get it again. Unfortunately, there are people who are getting it again. And it just doesn't portend well to try to pick up his support. But this leads me right back to what I said before. I think there's a part of him that actually, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I used to play basketball with this guy, and he was so sure he could beat me that he would take these real long shots and, you know, often miss. And I would beat him, not because he couldn't beat me, but he just wanted to make it harder for himself.
Do you think that, and I kind of hearing it from what you're saying, the Trump response to the coronavirus is what's potentially is what's doing him in on Election Day?
Well, he never really had a good approach to the virus, and why he would do an interview with Bob Woodward simultaneously to saying it's just like the flu, don't worry about it, we have it under control, it's under control. Then he finally has to admit there's a virus on March 13th. And within a week says he wants to reopen everything by April 12th, which just was not reading the seriousness of the virus at all. He and his vice president say that they've saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Well, in South Korea, They didn't lose even per capita nearly what the United States did, because they hit the virus in the face when it first started. And, you know, then he gets the virus, but, you know, just goes out to visit some people while he's in the Walter Reed Army Hospital. I mean, it's really a cavalier and kind of, cursory approach to a very, very serious malady. And I'm not trying to say that the medical people are always right, that the medical people should always be listened to. I have some problems with them myself. But I think when you look at the contagiousness of the virus, which the president acknowledges when he's not at a rally, if he loses, I say he loses because of the virus.
And that seems to be a lot of people are, you know, saying they're not discounting, but they're obviously this has been, you know, a generation or 100 year situation that we have not seen in, you know, how many years, 1918, 1919. So this is something that wherever he was before this year, he could have, you know, made it his own and transformed himself as a leader.
What I think he could have done was what Governor Cuomo did. At first, he didn't say, we're going to beat this. We said, we're going to have to do this. And if we do these things, we can win. You know, and then when the virus, we were losing 800 people a day in early April, and we got down to losing nobody in July, then he started to take a little bit of a victory lap. But even then, he warned that it might not be over yet. So I thought, he coalesced his political stances based on data and not whims. And I think that's the problem. How many times has the president told us this virus is going to go? It's going to go away. It's going to go away. I think a whole lot of people are going to go away before the virus does. And that's the tragedy of it.
Yeah. And even when he's mentioned this, he said several times, I think the number has been, you know, now it's about 215,000 have died in the United States. And he'll say on the other side of that it could have been, you know, hundreds of thousands, million or whatever, if he didn't do whatever it was from the ban with China early on. And that doesn't really help the fact that so many people have already died.
Well, he did do the ban with China, and that was progressive. And but he didn't do the ban with Europe. And that's why New York got hit first, because the Europeans and people from the United States who went to Europe and brought the virus back with them were coming to Kennedy International Airport. And so he does get a plus for doing China, but, you know, he kind of leaves out the things he didn't do. And, you know, we as a state were the epicenter of the virus, started in Westchester. And within a month, we were losing hundreds of people a day. But New Yorkers pulled together. You know, wearing masks are difficult. Social distancing is real difficult. But it, you know, has demonstrated that it can reduce the virus. I was shocked to see that the virus didn't go away in the summer. I thought most viruses do. This one did not.
Yeah, and I believe that was one of the lines that Trump had said, that it will, you know, in the warm weather, it will go away. Obviously, we haven't seen that here. We haven't seen that all along in the warmer states where it's been a problem. Why has wearing a mask become such a political symbol?
I really don't know. I mean, I almost feel as if the president had said wear a mask in the beginning, the Trump supporters would have worn it, and the people that didn't like him wouldn't have. We find things to argue about in this country now that absolutely alarm me. This is a medical issue, whether you think you should be wearing a mask or not, and it's been turned into a political issue, which is just, I just can't imagine the anxiety that I would feel from this source. We have got to find a way to start agreeing on at least what the medical protocol should be. But this idea of people who are wearing masks being shouted down in different places, and then vice versa, some people who did wear masks got shouted down as well. It's just, it is stirring the pot. And I think what is really a powder keg here in this country, I notice it walking around on the streets. When people are driving cars, they tell me about how aggressive the other drivers are and cutting people off in a traffic jam. Now that's really bright. Like you're going to get to wherever you're going 2 seconds before they do. But I think it's coming from, as I said before, this acrimony that has leaped the walls of just politics and has now filtered down right into our neighborhoods. You know, where you have people claiming religious right as they infect each other with the virus, and who has to take care of them? All of the rest of us. And all the religions of the world talk about this notion that when you're in a situation and there's a government and the government issues an edict, that you follow the edict. And every religion in some form or fashion teaches that, and no one's listening to it.
I want to ask you, you touched on obviously how New York has done and Governor Cuomo. Do you praise the way he managed this crisis from the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything. You know, you have to make these decisions, and I had the most difficult economic time since the Great Depression when I was in office, but my decisions were economic. They did have consequences for people who lost jobs or had to be laid off, or areas that we had to cut to balance our budget. But he literally has had to make decisions that really address the human life and what to do about people in hospitals and different places like that. And these are decisions that were being made with very little data, decisions made in March and April when we didn't even really know what the virus was. And you know, they say he asked for help from the federal government and they sent the comfort ship and he couldn't fill it. Well, that's because the numbers went down. So that, it didn't mean that this was his fault, that he wasted the taxpayer dollars. You know, I remember once, Jerry, I was lieutenant governor. I got these chest pains one night. I went to the hospital and they kept me overnight in the hospital. And then they let me go and they said, we can't really find the problem. They wrote in the newspaper that I wasted everybody's time in the hospital because I went there. So what should I do? Stay home and pray that I don't have a heart attack? And that's what I think Governor Cuomo's had to face, where I think if he could do some things over again, he probably would do them differently. But who did it better than him? Mayor de Blasio's bouncing back and forth. First he wants to close things, then he wants to open them. And then we have the president who's telling us we're not in a crisis when there are people perishing all around him. So I think the governor stood out during that particular time.
More of my interview with former New York Governor David Paterson ahead.
Two things I want to ask you about the governor. He's gotten some criticism for the way he dealt with nursing homes. Is that valid?
Well, I thought it was valid at one point, but when I did some research based on the law as applied to what nursing homes are compelled to do under the law, they couldn't blame the governor for treating COVID cases that they let into the hospital. And in the end, if they thought that that was not compliant with the law, it was up to them, not the governor, to make that decision. And the law speaks very clearly on that subject.
You mentioned Mayor de Blasio, and we've seen this not just from the pandemic, but at other times as well. There's been this almost a battle, and certainly we're seeing it in press conferences, in the media, between the governor and the mayor. When they opened schools, the mayor would make his statement, then Cuomo took over. I'm sure we've seen this in the past with administrations in the state and the city. But this seems to be at a different level between the two of them.
Yeah, it's been one of the more confrontational situations, contentious and at times a little over the top. But I think that what the governor did when he became governor, And I didn't have time to do it, but I knew that you have to do it. You've got to bring people in who can execute policy, who are implementers. I think Mayor de Blasio ran a great campaign. He won the trust of New Yorkers, but he just strikes me as not having a team around him that when you say, I want to do something, they can make it happen for him. And I think that's frustrated the governor, who is one of the great administrators in this country. He showed that he was at HUD. He showed what he was as attorney general. He showed what he was as a governor. Three completely different areas, one in housing, one in law enforcement, and one in public service. And I think when he sees that things don't happen quickly enough, I think his temper gets ignited. To be honest, so does mine.
Now, as great as New York has done, and they, you know, were really leading the way in the nation with the compliance with the rules that Governor Cuomo put in place, but not you know, for any fault of his doing, but there is an uptick, and he has been, you know, cautioning about this for months. We're seeing that now in different parts of Brooklyn and Queens and other areas, Rockland County as well, Orange County. Is it premature for the governor now to go on a book tour that in effect is a victory lap?
Well, you know, I think that because he became almost a national target, I mean, this is amazing. You do the best job reducing the virus in your state, and then you become a national target because you close things down. Meanwhile, the people in the states that are criticizing them are having exponential increases in the acquiring of the virus and in the death toll. And so I think what the governor, what may have generated this book, I haven't asked him about this, is that he'd like people to hear his side of the story. And I wanted people to hear my side of the story, but I waited 10 years to write my book, because if I wrote what I really thought, it would be far more intense than the book that I wrote.
That's a good place for a segue. I want to ask you about that book. It's Black, Blind, and in Charge, A Story of Visionary Leadership and Overcoming Adversity. It is by Skyhorse. Why did you want to do it now? And what will we learn? Is there some new nugget that we're going to learn about you?
Well, I think I probably wanted to write years ago, but I knew that I had not completely cleared myself of the anxiety and the frustration and almost like the desire to settle scores. And sometimes you have to realize that you just have to move on and, you know, accord yourself with the decorum that you always did and not get into, these types of vindictive situations. So when I was ready to write, they said to me that I couldn't do that because people don't read books anymore. And not only that, but they don't care about what happened in politics 10 years ago. Well, I think we've totally dispelled that, because we sold out on Amazon earlier. The incident involving what happened with Governor Spitzer and why he had to resign and some of the details of it that were never really known before, the issue of even Donald Trump, who dropped by a few times to advise me on how to run the administration. And by the way, wasn't always wrong. And then, you know, just the issue of the fiscal crisis of 2008 and the elimination of the member items, which the public was calling for years, but the legislature never did it. I made that happen. We had no procurement between the state and minority and women-owned businesses, like 5% for all the minority-owned and all the women-owned businesses until I got there. And we closed $40 billion of debt in 33 months, which has got to be a record. And when someone does that, it's not likely they'll be coming back for another term. And I didn't have any problem with that. I just didn't want history to look back and see that I was the one that couldn't stop the state from going into default. And I was able to do that.
And you talk about overcoming adversity. You talk in the title, being blind, Black, both very rare for being a governor, not just in New York, but in the entire nation.
There's only one other person who was blind who ran a state. And it was 11 days in 1975 when the governor resigned and he promoted his lieutenant governor to governor for 11 days. Now, my view is, if in those 11 days you never passed a budget, you've never really been a governor.
And that was in, was that in Arkansas? Did I read that?
That was in the state of Alabama.
Alabama, okay. So talk a little about that, about how, you know, being blind.
And- I may be wrong, Jerry. That might have been in the state of Illinois.
Illinois?
I think the person's name was Robert C. Riley. Okay. But you were asking me.
Oh, no. I was just wondering, you're being a governor in New York. It's a high-pressure job, and you're doing this while you're blind. I mean, that has to be very difficult to, you know, you're putting in, different skill set.
Well, you know, Jerry, I was one of the first blind students, one of the first disabled students to be assimilated into a public school population. My parents had to get a house in Long Island so I could go to the Hempstead Public School System, which was one of the three top school systems in the country at the time, and had done that already. But one of the critical mistakes that was made with me and other low vision students, I'm legally blind, I have no vision in the left eye and something like 20 over 400 in the right eye. But we weren't taught Braille. There was this new idea that you could tape things or put them on vinyl records. And no one ever looked at the data that the things that you see, you recall very well. The things that you feel, as in when you're using your hands for Braille, give you like 80 to 90% comprehension. The things you hear or give you at times below 50% comprehension. So it didn't really help. So in 2009, I delivered a State of the State address for 63 minutes. And during that time, I didn't have a note because I couldn't read it. If I could have done it in Braille, I could have read it just like anyone else. And the week that I spent memorizing all that material hurt me because there were a number of issues, particularly the appointment of a United States senator that got botched, that I don't think would have been the case have I paid the attention to it that it deserved.
And I remember when I interviewed you, when you were doing a talk show, you had just had to learn all of this information and have it just stored because you couldn't, you know, you weren't doing it in Braille. You couldn't read it off of a monitor or if a newspaper. So you had it right there in a data bank in your brain.
Yeah, that was really tested my memory capacity, but it was a hindrance. And I thought, and you know, political people write these books, they never acknowledge that they did anything wrong. These books are boring. And I thought I would address it where I could address my own shortcomings. And perhaps I should have, when I got old enough, learned Braille, anticipating that something like this might happen. But at the same time, I, you know, was able to point out my achievements just like anyone else. But it sounded more like a human being and not a robot that never gets anything wrong.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you, Governor? And is another book on the way?
Learn from this process is that I'm not a bad writer, that there were very few edits made to the writing that I did. And I might want to write on other subjects. It's not all about me. There are other things going on in the world that I think deserve redress. And I might consider that moving forward. Of course, I'm still the senior vice president of Las Vegas Sands Corporation. And we're trying to get one of the licenses if casino gambling, as it should, opens in 2023. We'd like to open it sooner. The state would get more taxes from if we were to win, or really whoever wins, and would help to cut this prohibitive budget deficit that we're in now, really because of the virus, not because of mismanagement.
And where would that be? Where are you looking to have casinos?
You know, that's the question everybody asks, Jerry. You're right on target. And they don't cite the casinos until they pick the licensees. Oh. So I don't really know where it would be. You know, a number of people support the idea but don't want it in their backyard. But what I would advise some neighborhoods is what you would want after this pandemic right now are jobs in your community. And reigniting the engine of your local economy as much as the national one. So somebody is going to heed that advice and invite the casinos in. And you will see the same thing that you see in Las Vegas and the other big cities that manage them right, that they become a strong revenue generator for the local neighborhood in which they reside.
It is always a pleasure to speak to you. Former Governor of New York, David Paterson. Again, his new book is called Black, Blind, and in Charge, a story of visionary leadership and overcoming adversity. It is by Skyhorse Publishing. Governor Paterson, thank you so much for a few minutes of your time today.
Thank you, Jerry. Take care.
You too. I want to take a moment to mention a couple of comments received on Apple Podcasts. Rob in North Carolina said in part, "Wonderful job on the interview." The UD Network wrote, "The first episode with Anthony Scaramucci was great. Humbling. Wow, I appreciate the feedback. Thanks for listening. If you haven't yet, please subscribe and tell your friends. Are you listening on Apple? Please give a 5-star rating and leave a comment. I'm looking to get this podcast in front of as many ears as possible. I encourage all comments, whether it's by email at hearnowthenewsjb@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at Jerry Barmash or our Facebook page, Hear Now the News with Jerry Barmash. On Monday, November 9th, the next episode will be available. As we wait to see who the winner of the election is, I'll talk to a constitutional law expert about the president's threats to fight a loss and upend the transfer of power. I'll also talk to Hofstra professor James Sample about the Democrats bringing the 25th Amendment into the discussion. Thanks so much for listening to Hear Now the News. I'm Jerry Barnash.